From the Sky News Centre at 5, US media are reporting that investigators have reason to believe a woman who took part in a mass shooting in California had sworn allegiance to Islamic State. Tashfeen Malik and her husband Saeed Farouk killed 14 people in an attack on a social services centre in San Bernardino on Wednesday. Our reporter Greg Milam is at the scene.
It appears it wasn't posted on her own Facebook account, and they're looking at how it was posted, if it was posted on a mobile device. And when exactly it happened, we know that the police have found what seemed to be damaged mobile phones near one of the scenes.
A woman who was kept prisoner by her own father for 30 years says she's overwhelmed with relief after he was convicted of a series of offences. 75-year-old Aravindan Balakrishnan was found guilty of sexual assault, child cruelty and false imprisonment. His daughter says he left her powerless and degraded.
He used to say that the lightning will strike me dead if I went out of the house, or that I will spontaneously combust if I went out on my own. And also there was the fear that, because there was nothing for me outside that I knew.
An arrest warrant has been issued for Oscar Pistorius a day after his conviction was upgraded to murder. The athlete was originally convicted of manslaughter for killing his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp on Valentine's Day in 2013. He now faces up to 15 years in prison when he's re-sentenced. Police are investigating whether two MPs have been wrongly claiming expenses. The parliamentary watchdog has referred three cases to Scotland Yard, one of which has been finalised. Commuters, residents and businesses on both sides of the Forth Road Bridge are preparing for major disruption after being told the crossing will be closed until January. It's due to essential safety work after a crack was discovered in steelwork. And rail passengers will benefit from the smallest increase in rail prices in 6 years. That's the latest. I'm Adam Lindsay.
This is your award-winning BCFM.
BCFM
on 93.2,
24 hours a day.
BCFM 93.2,
your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Labour councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, as the mainstream media broadcasts and prints wall-to-wall reasons to bomb Syria and shows pictures of RAF jets against the sunset rather than the devastation below, we look behind the veil at this post-9/11 neocon era of NATO's unending wars and the balkanisation of the Middle East. Hearing from some of the neocons behind it all, and we ask, while many of its fighters were trained next door in Jordan, why has ISIS not been attacking their supposed mortal enemy, Israel? Are we being dragged into a war in Syria or with Syria? Putin is welcoming Britain's support, but will Russia and NATO ultimately end up fighting over the control of Syria and her oil? And claims of 70,000 moderate rebels ready to fight on the ground in support of the RAF and US Air Force. Last we heard, there were only 70. Where did the extra 70,000 come from? And can we rely on John Day, chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, where the source of this 70,000 information? Plus, closer to home, what is Bristol's own Stop the War group doing? Our city's so-called terrorist sympathisers, what are they planning? Martin Summers will also have a chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. It's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius, dry but windy. Highs this weekend of 14 Celsius, still fairly mild. Cloudy and windy on Saturday, showers on Sunday. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius, plenty of sunny spells this week, but also a few showers, getting less windy as the week progresses. Next weekend, that's the 14th and 15th of December, highs of 11 Celsius, sunny spells and light rain. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Labour Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Hi, Ron, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, nice to see you all.
Are you a terrorist sympathiser, Ron?
Well, according to Mr. Cameron, yes. In truth, no.
Why, what do you make of the remarks? Because these really have caused a lot of upset across the country, and many people saying, well, you know, is this just actually not prime ministerial to say this sort of thing?
Well, I think it's completely offensive, and you should withdraw them. The problem we got, of course, is he made those comments in Westminster where they've got parliamentary privilege to call anybody anything and get away with it. And, you know, it's a difficult issue that people genuinely should stay their consciences on. And whether they voted one way or the other, the people that felt that there was no actual benefit from it didn't take that decision lightly. And to be called a terrorist, I think, is highly insulting.
Well, not a terrorist, but a terrorist sympathiser.
Well, outright.
So it's almost like people are trying to make excuse for this for the terrorists. But, of course, it's quite the country is quite finely divided as to whether they think that bombing Syria is a good idea or not, aren't they?
Well, let's face it. I mean, Syria in its current form, I think, doubt there's anything that's worth saving standing still. And we've had bombing for the last 12 months, if not longer. And we've still got international terrorist incidents happening. And so it won't work, and it won't work, and it can't work. And because of the way in which terrorist groups are tending to target people or communities or countries, you can't be even safe in your own community, as you saw in America, in San Diego.
San Bernardino, I think.
San Bernardino.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, just bring you straight in here, because I've been looking around online at several of these government leaflets which are meant to warn parents about whether their young people are being radicalised. Just literally chatting to some people today, just randomly chatting. They're saying, well my children are terrorist sympathisers. This particular piece of guidance is from Camden Council, Safeguarding Children Board. It says keeping children and young people safe from radicalisation and extremism, advice for parents and carers. And the whole point really here is that it's a whole checklist to run through, and if you find your children reacting in this certain way, the advice is to start discussing the children's behaviour with even reporting it, you might say, to schools, that sort of thing. Amongst the list of things which Camden lists as being signs of radicalisation are showing a mistrust of mainstream media reports and belief in conspiracy theories.
Well, the whole thing of terrorist sympathiser is pretty rich coming from Cameron, because Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, made it clear 2 years ago on French TV that he was approached by British officials who said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate? And Cameron himself says there are 70,000 rebels in Syria which he is prepared to support. And we have been supporting. We've been supporting them with weaponry, we've been supporting them politically, and we've also been supporting them with money. So who is a terrorist? Cameron isn't a terrorist sympathiser. He's a terrorist. He's complicit with terrorism inside Syria, as the Russians have been pointing out. So let's get absolutely clear about what's been going on here. There has been a terrorist campaign inside Syria which has killed tens of thousands of people, and Britain is implicated in that campaign. So let's get absolutely clear about what we're talking about
before we go any further. You're talking about Cameron, aren't you?
No, I know.
When Roland Dumas was talking about this, he said a year or so before the Arab Spring started. Now, he's starting to get into the territory which was actually a Labour government with Gordon Brown in charge.
Well, in actual fact, I would have to look at the actual timescale there.
Well, looked at it, and it's the tail end of the Labour government
That doesn't surprise me either, because in actual fact, this is a plot hatched by MI6 and CIA, probably cooperating with the Israelis, which goes back probably decades, the plan to take down the Syrian government has been there all along, and they have armed and trained. I mean, the moderate terrorists that Cameron is supporting are in fact Al-Qaeda Syria, the Al-Nusra Front, the people who carried out the chemical weapons attack, which Cameron tried to blame on the Assad regime. So it's pretty rich coming from Cameron about others being terrorist sympathisers, when it's on the record that British intelligence and special forces have been arming and training radical elements inside Syria. And also, of course, been involved in recruiting lots and lots of jihadis from all over the world. There's 70,000, at least 70,000 foreign fighters inside Syria. They got into Syria via Turkey, a NATO ally of ours, and they were trained and armed by our people and sent into Syria to bring down the government. That's terrorism.
Now, you're showing sympathy for extremist causes, Martin.
Well, all of this stuff about how we know what we know is, for example, that a 16-year-old British girl went to Syria, having been groomed online to go there. She was actually stopped by the Turkish police, who do have some independence of the government, and they arrested the person who was grooming her, who turned out to be a Canadian intelligence agent. We also have the evidence where a Swedish national was on trial at the Old Bailey, charged with planning to go to Syria to join an extremist group, and his defence lawyers just pointed out that the extremist group he was going to join, for which he was being prosecuted, was actually being armed and supported by MI6. The case was dropped. So a lot of the mainstream debate about this is simply fraudulent. Britain has been involved in supporting terrorism in Syria and in recruiting people from all over the Middle East and elsewhere to fight in Syria. And if we really want to get to the bottom of that, it's not a question of interrogating teenagers about what they're doing online. We should be asking who is actually recruiting them online and finding out who they are, because they are probably linked to our own intelligence.
Now, Ron, Camden Council are saying that you may be radicalised. It's a good idea to do something about it if you're a parent, if your children are showing a mistrust of mainstream media reports and a belief in conspiracy theories, also if they're appearing angry about government policies, especially foreign policy.
Never heard anything so stupid in all my life. I mean, my two children came up in an environment in my home where I am always cynical of mainstream policy and as portrayed by the media. And yes, I get angry too.
Well, yes, they seem to be saying.
I also got a dark dress, and I support radical groups like you see, CND, you know. So does that make me a terrorist? Probably.
What they seem to be saying here, Ron, is that basically the mainstream media is the truth, and if you question it, then you're a terrorist sympathiser or you have been radicalised, and you should be targeted by the government to make sure that you're not becoming any more radical.
Well, the only radicalisation that happened to me through my youth was from my grandfather, who taught me social politics, taught me the social values, taught me the political values that I hold now and espouse. And I thank him for that, because I think my views and his views are the views of everybody, that, and there are general families in East Bristol. And, you know, it happens. But in relation to the issue that you're talking about, so the international radicalism and people pushing, should we say, their own agenda, their jihad against whoever. I mean, we're going back to the Crusades and Richard the Lionheart and Saladin, aren't we?
We are. And Martin, one of the implications of all this is that we're effectively sort of moving towards the idea of criminalising dissent, saying that you've got to keep an eye on people who are questioning what the mainstream, getting angry about government foreign policy, this kind of thing. This is actually quite sinister, isn't it?
It is indeed very sinister, especially given the context which I've just explained.
I thought this was what our freedoms. I thought these were the freedoms we were supposed to be protecting.
Well, indeed, you may well say so. And of course, we've already got perfectly good laws against people expressing support for violence or racism or anything like that. So why do we need to have somebody vetting political opinions other than that? There's no reason at all. I think if you, Ron will remember back to the 80s where Sinn Féin were not allowed to speak on British television. And therefore we had the ridiculous scenario of people speaking and then somebody speaking on their behalf so that we could hear what the actual policy was. The Iranian general staff and the Russian general staff are absolutely clear that virtually all jihadi extremism in the Middle East and elsewhere is being run by the Western intelligence services. But you don't hear about that on Radio 4, do you? Now, you'd have thought that Radio 4 and the BBC would have a responsibility to explain the position of General Ivashov, for example, who used to be the head of the Russian armed forces, saying that 9/11 was an inside job and he believes that the Western intelligence services were involved.
I mean, if I was still working at the BBC, I'd be saying we need to give some voices to Syrians.
Well, indeed. The point is, even if they're wrong, ordinary people in Britain should know that that's what the Russians think. But they don't know that because they're not told.
Ron, what do you make of all this? Do you think it's OK to roll these sorts of similar policies out here in Bristol to say that if your children are appearing angry about government policies, foreign policy, if they're showing a mistrust of the mainstream media, then they should be reported to their school, they should have an eye kept on them?
No, I don't think we go down that route. I do think the one local girl that left, if you remember, with a group of friends and got as far as the border, was a wake-up call to Bristol, that within East Bristol there is the ability for radicalisation to be aimed at young people. And it was sad because obviously it was concern for the family. I think we need to go and forget what Camden's saying and look really at issues of young people and where they are, how they are, how they react, and what we can do to counteract, if you like, of radicalism.
In the past, anyway, Bristol has not accepted the prevent strategy. It said, well, hang on a minute, we're going to have to tweak this before we implement it in Bristol. We're not having this from Westminster. Another example here of why people might get annoyed, even angry, with the mainstream media is we've had a story going around the world for the last couple of days about bullying of MPs who were thinking about possibly voting for the motion to bomb Syria. And it turns out that this is a lot of this anyway is certainly is nonsense. We march for peace, not to bully, Stella Creasy. This is a story from Walthamstow which kicked all this off. There was reports of people surrounding the house of an MP to bully them. Well, as it turns out, it was nothing of the sort. As Red Pepper reports, it was actually the local constituency office that there was a peace vigil held outside, and notes put through someone's door were not their own personal door, it was the constituency office. This was all based around. So what we're having is a sort of the reaction of the press right around the country to this, Martin, has been effectively based on a lie.
Well, indeed, and I think in actual fact, coming back to the earlier point, why shouldn't people express themselves to their local MP, whatever their views may be? And, you know, they're supposed to be adults, and if somebody says, if you vote for this, I'm going to be minded to deselect you if I get the opportunity, well, that's a perfectly reasonable thing for the people to say, isn't it? That's politics.
Well, why don't these journalists check? Well, what's going on here? The journalists aren't checking to see if the story's true before they're reporting it around the country.
Well, what they're doing is they're giving the Blairites in the Labour Party an easy ride, which is that they're being bullied, it seems, by activists and their position is being undermined and so on. Now, I think that those ladies and gentlemen who voted for the war must have had their reasons to vote for it, and, you know, they would no doubt perhaps come on this show and justify them. But other people equally do not agree with them, and there are political consequences for any decision you take. An obvious point to make is that the Tories, for their own reasons, are going to redraw constituency boundaries, which means there will be reselections or deselections of various Labour MPs. And it's perfectly legitimate for Labour activists, who are now, you know, many thousands strong as a result of the Corbyn campaign, saying to those people, you can vote for this if you like, but we will get our vote about you further down the line.
Ron,
how politics works.
What, Ron, another thing that's as a spin-off after the Syria vote this week has been the finger being pointed at Momentum as this kind of quasi to do with the Labour Party. It's a little bit like Labour Militant back in the 1980s, where there's
this time is online.
So tell us a little bit about this. There is something a bit strange, isn't there, about an organisation that is mainly made up of Labour Party members but actually isn't part of the Labour Party.
Well, I'm obviously not a member. I'm not on Facebook and Twitter, so I haven't read what they've said. But clearly, we've got an issue in the Labour Party with groups that don't like the outcome of the leadership. And various groups, I suspect, in different forms, are trying to destabilise that. And possibly, if you like, call into question when you get differences of opinion, as on the vote that we had, you know, between Hilary Bannon as Foreign Minister and Jeremy Corbyn as the leader. And then immediately the media pushes to the point of Hilary Bannon will be the next leader of the Labour Party. Well, we've all had an individual vote on that, and the result was that Jeremy Corbyn won a massive majority. And, you know, this is something we've got to manage in-house, but the fact that it's out online is the most sinister part of it. And, you know, even on local media, we get people that are sniping at various people for what you do, what you say. And it's wrong, and that's one of the reasons I just don't go bother with it, because I just can't be fussed to even react to
there,
it.
There has also been criticism of this Young Britons Foundation, which is maybe a similar sort of group, obviously not similar politically, but it's again another organisation which is loosely affiliated with the Conservative Party. Martin, also has been in the news this over the last few weeks, although not probably as prominently as some of the stuff about Momentum, perhaps, but over the an activist who committed suicide as part of this group. Tory bullying claims. Activist father says Cameron must distance himself from this cult youth group. This is the Young Britons Foundation. The Prime Minister has not done enough to distance himself and his party from a Conservative youth group linked to the Tory bullying scandal, according to the father of a young activist who is believed to have killed himself. Ray Johnson, father of Elliot, who was found dead on railway tracks after allegedly being bullied, wrote to David Cameron to complain about the Young Britons Foundation, with which Elliot had been involved, describing it as a cult. YBF, a Conservative training, education and research think tank, mentored, among others, Mark Clark, election aide, accused of bullying Elliot. Clark has denied all allegations of bullying and wrongdoing. In his reply to Johnson, Cameron said the organisation is independent from the Conservative Party. He can't control who's invited to attend its events.
Well, I mean, there's obviously an issue concerning bullying here, which is separable from any of the politics involved. Bullying is unacceptable in any walk of life, and you know, if there has been bullying here, then and that's led to somebody committing suicide, then that should be dealt with in the appropriate fashion. But I repeat what I said earlier. People are getting a little bit too childlike about all of this. Politics is a rough old trade. People have different, fairly well, firmly held views, and they're going to express them. And there's going to be, you know, sometimes a bit of heat in the way in which those views are expressed. That is the way politics works.
With the reporting of the Young Britain Foundation, there's been a reluctance to report some of the sexual sides of this, with sexual intimidation going on too.
That is all absolutely reprehensible and should be, no doubt, be dealt with. Coming back to the question about Momentum, Militant was an organisation with an internal structure which was based on a Marxist-Leninist idea of a central committee which was separable from the Labour Party and so on. So you could argue that they were, and it's the Labour Party has got a right to decide whether they're going to have people in or out. People get expelled. It may be, you see, as in New Zealand, that we will come to a point where those who voted for the war will be expelled from the Labour Party. That's what happened in New Zealand. The right wing of the Labour Party were expelled by the left wing. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it's a perfectly reasonable thing to happen, and that's what politics is about. It's a rough old trade.
Well, let's go back to the House of Commons on Wednesday. No Prime Minister's questions, but a very long debate on Syria, and here now from the speech, opening speech, in fact, from the Prime Minister, David Cameron.
If there is an attack on the UK in the coming weeks or months, there will be those who try to say it's happened because of our airstrikes. I do not believe that would be the case. Daesh have been trying to attack us for the last year, as we know from the 7 different plots that our security services have foiled. The terrorist threat level to the UK was raised to severe last August in the light of the threat from Daesh, meaning an attack is highly likely. 2 minutes. 800 people, including families and children, have been radicalised to such an extent that they've travelled to this so-called caliphate. The House should be under no illusion. These terrorists are plotting to kill us and to radicalise our children right now. They attack us because of who we are, not because of what we do. British Muslims are appalled by Daesh. Yeah. These women-raping, Muslim-murdering, medieval monsters, they are hijacking the peaceful religion of Islam for their warped ends. As the King of Jordan says in his article today, these people are not Muslims, they are outlaws from Islam. And we must stand with our Muslim friends here and around the world as they reclaim their religion from these terrorists. So far from an attack on Islam, we are engaged in a defence of Islam. And far from the risk of radicalising British Muslims by acting, failing to act would actually be to betray British Muslims and the wider religion of Islam in its very hour of need.
Well, in that case, he will actually put pressure on the Turkish government to stop buying oil from ISIS, which they've been doing, as the Russians have pointed out. Bilal Erdogan, the son of the president of Turkey, has been personally profiting from the oil trade with ISIS.
Well, no doubt David Cameron has been putting pressure on Turkey.
No, he has not. In actual fact, he's supported Obama in supporting the Turks in shooting down the Russian aircraft, which was bombing these supply lines. Also, of course, he mentioned Jordan there. That's very interesting he mentioned Jordan, because British Special Forces have definitely been in Jordan, definitely training so-called moderate rebels, otherwise known as Al-Qaeda, to overthrow the government of Syria. Al-Qaeda is still, of course, dedicated, at least in its ostensible statements, to attacking British civilians, etc. And as I come back to what I said earlier in this programme, the evidence for NATO intelligence services, including our own intelligence services' intimate involvement with Islamist terrorism, goes back decades. And in actual fact, if we're going to be serious about attacking ISIS, we need to go to war with Turkey. Turkey's part of NATO, but we need to actually, I'm not a pacifist, if they're serious about dealing with ISIS, we should get together with the Russians, go to war with Turkey, and allow Kurdistan to be free, and all the rest of it. But of course, we need to overthrow the government of Saudi Arabia, cut off the head of the snake, let's have some democratic revolution there, and of course, it's not peaceful democratic revolution, the sort of thing we support in Libya and in Syria involves car bombs, it involves assassinations, that's definitely part of our policy. So if that's what we're talking about, let's go the whole hog and fight Turkey, fight Saudi Arabia. Let's clear the nest of vipers out of the Middle East. But that, of course, means going to war with ourselves. And an obvious target, for example, for our own air attacks might be, you know, those who sell weaponry to the Saudis, who are clearly the biggest supporters of ISIS. And where does that leave us?
Ron Stone, the Prime Minister there talked about these medieval monsters, but it's not the only sort of aspect to all of this, which does start to look like these kind of medieval crusade. I mean, we've got the State of Israel, for example, which is a kind of crusader state. A lot of people in the Middle East talk about it as a crusader state. So it almost looks like we're cooking up here, we're involved anyway in cooking up, because Britain has certainly been involved in the creation of the State of Israel, a kind of rematch, a remake of the medieval crusades.
Well, I did say that earlier, didn't I? And I think the other problem that's tied up in all this is natural resources and the oil abilities and certain, shall we say, agreements that we've made with different countries on supply and making sure that we've got supplies, etc. And so I think it's such a multifaceted issue. And, you know, with religion caught in the middle, and people of all those religions, the general people are fine, but you've got, again, that tied in with politics, and the whole thing is such a ragbag and mixture. It's very difficult to be able to isolate it. And if Martin, I've got no reason to doubt what you're saying in relation to the information he's given you, that if we've got secret services involved with it as well, then what chance do we stand?
Well, let's hear the other side now. And the second speaker in the debate on Wednesday was the Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn.
For all members, take a decision that will put British servicemen and women in harm's way and almost inevitably lead to the deaths of innocents is a heavy responsibility. It must be treated with the utmost seriousness and respect given to those who make a different judgment about the right course of action to take. Whether it's a lack of strategy worth the name, the absence of credible ground troops, the missing diplomatic plan for a Syrian settlement, the failure to address the impact of the terrorist threat, or the refugee crisis and civilian casualties, it's becoming increasingly clear that the Prime Minister's proposals for military action simply do not stack up. The Prime Minister has not offered a serious assessment, in my view, of the intensified air campaign on civilian casualties in ISIL-held Syrian territory or the wider Syrian refugee crisis. At least 250,000 have already been killed in Syria's terrible civil war. 11 million made homeless and 4 million forced to leave the country. Many more have been killed by the Assad regime than by ISIL itself. Yet more bombing in Syria will kill innocent civilians. There's no doubt about that. And turn many more Syrians into refugees.
Well, I agree with all of that. But, of course, he's missing the fundamental point. I did send him the clip of Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, basically calling out Britain for starting the uprising in Syria. And the evidence is there. It's on the record.
OK, even if the evidence is there, Martin, and now we're in a different situation, aren't we? We've got to deal with the situation as we find it now. There's no point in just trying to recycle to 2009. No,
if it is the case that our own intelligence services recruited people from all over the Middle East and then funneled them into Syria to start a war in Syria, if we want to put a stop to what's going on, we need to actually set the police on our own intelligence services, which is what I say every week on this show, as I have for the last 5 years. There is a fundamental problem. Going back to the 1980s, Operation Cyclone, when Al-Qaeda was set up by MI6 and the CIA in order to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. The Russians know all about this, of course, which is why they're saying, you are not serious about tackling ISIS. We are.
Well, no, they're not, actually. They're saying, thank you very much for joining us, actually. They're being very polite about it all. Anyway, one of the key debates or key speeches during the debate was that by Hilary Benn, Shadow Foreign Secretary. But rather than hear that, I thought we'd hear from his dad, Tony Benn, who gave a speech in 2006, nearly 10 years ago, at an event, inaugural Benn lecture, which I helped organise back in 2006. And this is what Tony Benn had to say, former Bristol MP, left-wing Labour MP and minister, cabinet minister, in fact. In one point, he was even standing for the leadership of the Labour Party, on journalism and war. A bit of advice, maybe, for his son.
Journalists must be able to write freely, because their freedom, like freedom of members of Parliament, they don't always exercise it, but it should be there. And the moral responsibility of journalism is of enormous importance. I came back in a troop ship in the summer of 1945, and I heard the words of the Charter, the preamble of the Charter of the UN, and they're written in my heart. It said something very simple. It said, we the peoples of the United Nations. It didn't say we the coalition of the willing or we the free peoples or whatever. We the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has caused untold suffering to mankind. That was the pledge my generation, I'm 81, gave to the younger generation, and we tore it up when we went into Iraq. And UNESCO had a preamble in a way even simpler. It said, since war begins in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the defences of peace must be constructed. And that is what journalism should be able to do, to make it possible for people to see the simple, plain, stark truth that this generation is the first generation in human history that has the power to destroy the human race, kill one or two with a bow and arrow or a spear or a machine gun or a bomb. But with nuclear, chemical and biological weapons, it is possible to destroy the human race. But also, it's the first generation in human history that has the technology and the know-how and the money to solve the problems of the human race. A fraction of the cost of the war or the Trident, and everyone in Africa with AIDS would have had free drugs. Bush could have protected New Orleans from the Katrina. There could be a health service in America. And that's the choice. And so the information we get about that choice is crucial to our survival and integral to the role of the journalist.
That's Tony Benn there speaking nearly 9 years ago in the Arnold Feeney, the first inaugural Benn lecture. Ron, what do you make of the two Benns?
Well, I was with Hilary Benn 2 weeks ago, and that was handing over £500 to a local children's charity. And we raised that from the street art tribute to his father. It's on the side of the constituency office. I think, in a way, both of them are as different as chalk and cheese, really. Tony, as you can hear, had the ability to be able to take a very difficult subject right down to the grassroots voter and explain it in simple terms without being patronising, that people left the hall and fully understood what he was saying, why he was saying it. Some of them may not have agreed with it, but at least he could explain what he was doing. Now, Hillary has got a lower profile, or had a lower profile for a while in the Labour Party. But people were surprised at the, if you like, passion and rhetoric that he was able to come out with his defence of the position for the government. And my answer to that is, it's in the genes and the chromosomes. You know, he is his father's son, after all. And both of them, you know, in that case, he made a good speech. However, I still think, for all the reasons that he explained in his speech, and all the threats that were outlined and the issues that have been raised, it still comes back to the fact that we have been doing, bombing has gone on for over a 12-month, and international terrorist activities have not been depressed or stopped by doing it. And there is a vacuum after you do it. How long do you do it for? And then what do you do after? And how do you, if you like, try to rebuild Syria? And that has not got solid answers. It doesn't stack up.
In Hillary's Benn speech, Martin, he cites Franco, Hitler, Mussolini, saying basically it's like the beginning of World War II, fighting fascism, fighting ISIS.
Well, in that case, he might agree with the Russians that we should actually support the Assad regime, who have in fact won a democratic election inside Syria, not that it's been properly reported in our own media. And the Russians are saying, right, well, let's form an anti-fascist coalition and crush ISIS, but you will have to accept that the Iranians and Assad are on your side. And we'll have to deal with other problems in the Middle East as we go. So, for example, justice for the Palestinians, democratic elections in Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, etc. And of course, we're not interested in any of that. The whole thing is what the Russians are basically saying. I take your point that they were saying, yes, thank you, Britain, for joining us in this campaign. Because, of course, the RAF jets that flew from Akrotiri had to fly across Russian-controlled airspace to drop their bombs in eastern Syria. And the deal is between NATO and the Russians, we will tell you where our planes are, and you tell us where your planes are, so that we don't accidentally shoot each other down. Now, will Hillary Benn condemn the ambush of the Russian Su-24 in Syrian territory, which was a deliberate attempt to provoke the Russians and the Syrian regime? Will he condemn them? And I don't think he will he? Because in actual fact, there is the serious policy, as most people realise, if we want to go to war in Syria, is to ally with Assad and the Russians against the Turks. Are we prepared to do that? No, we're not.
Okay, on to some local stories now. Well, I say local, Newport. Take a look at where Newport's homeless could soon be living. This is in the South Wales Argus. Newport Lib Dem campaigner is looking for funding to create temporary homes for homeless people in the city. Created by Newport East candidate Paul Halliday, the scheme could provide short-term accommodation within 24 hours of someone ending up on the streets. He believes housing pods, he calls them, will change the life for the better, and has made his personal mission to get the scheme underway. Now, Newport up until recently was talking about massive fines, in fact up to £1,000, Ron Stone, Labour councillor here in Bristol, for people who are sleeping rough. They've now decided to ditch that, and they're going to be putting homeless people in crates instead.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can't see how they had hoped to get and fine anybody that's sleeping rough. I mean, I think that's just an idiot suggestion. I'm glad they've withdrawn that. But this isn't a new idea. Using cargo containers as temporary housing and stacking them has been on the agenda for at least the last 2 years. Brighton had a go at it. And even George's, our city mayor, is trying to promote the idea. I think it'd be far better if he actually offered the homeless in Bristol the use of his penthouse flat in Bedminster, because from the coverage he got in local media, and I think it was Tuesday, sat in this massive penthouse kitchen come dining room, you could probably get about 50 in there. And much better than this. I mean, yes, they try to make them, should we say, secure and better than sleeping in a doorway.
It looks a bit like a shipping container, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I understand you've been discussing housing today, Ron.
Yes.
If you could just give us a report back from that, what's been going on?
Well, I had a meeting with various members of the Labour Party and Marvin with Joe Anderson, the Mayor of Liverpool.
This is your mayor candidate?
Yes, and obviously what will happen, Bristol's got a housing crisis that we've discussed before. We've got a totally unacceptable number of somewhere between 12,000 and 14,000 people on a waiting list, and we need to do something radical about it. But what we've got to change is the council's attitude to this problem.
So what are they doing in Liverpool, and can we learn from that here in Bristol, and is Mayor Ferguson likely to listen?
Well, yes. I mean, what they've done there is they had a number of voided properties that were shut up and derelict, and they sold them to people for £1, and they took them on and redecorated and made them better. And instead of having the cost of having to work through a programme of renewal, it was done by housing agencies, interested parties and whatever. And so it made use of accommodation that is available much more quicker and easier. And that's one thing that we need to look at. But also we've got plans for eco-homes on 85 sites in the city. They meet the highest eco standard and leave you with a bill in the highest winter quarter of £20 for heating it. And in using the 85 sites, we save money from not fly tipping and having to clear it up and keep those sites clean. And so we've got very close, if you like, parallel ideas to Liverpool. But what we need to do is to build the partnerships between the RSLs and the housing associations.
An RSL? What's an RSL?
Well, it's the housing association structures and ourselves to be able to do that.
I mean, the king, we've been talking about this for years, Ron. Council's got loads of property. Why don't you just let people move in and renovate it?
Well, this is the point. I've just asked questions and got the answers to how many houses we've got on our books. They are void at the minute. It's 587.
Okay, so if some squatters move in and they start renovating one of your houses, are you going to evict them?
Well, in the past, yes. In the future, hopefully not. If they're there for a proper reason and we can find a way of working with that group, then I think we should be able to work with that and to get these properties out with people living in them.
But will the mayor wear that?
Probably not, which is why we need to change the city mayor.
I mean, I saw him
on
Points West last week, I think it was, saying, here's a nice bit of property, we need to get it sorted out for Christmas for Bristol's homeless. We've got too many and an explosion in people sleeping rough in the city.
Well, I know that, but I'm afraid he and his bureaucracy that he sits on top of only work within the housing revenue account and the headroom in it, and are not radically thinking outside
the box. You're talking about here about squatters who are prepared to do places up for nothing. You're not talking about it costing the council anything, apart from if they decide to evict them.
Well, I'll believe it if he's saying that when he does it, because he's had 3.5 years to actually do something about the housing list, and virtually nothing's happened.
On to another story. Minister says he will have a final say on Lancashire fracking plan. This is in the Independent this time last week. Government is accused of of trying to impose fracking on communities after a decision is taken out of planning inspectors' hands. Environmental campaigners have accused ministers of bypassing local democracy after the government said it would have the final say on controversial plans for fracking in Lancashire. Whatever the recommendation of local planning inspectors, locals can now veto wind farms. So what about fracking? Now, Martin, this is a big issue down here because of they're talking about this going on in the fracking in the Mendips. And what's happened in Lancashire is they've had a whole, gone through a whole process of deciding democratically whether people want it. They've had a very good look at it and say, we're not having it round here. And the minister's saying, well, sorry, but we're going to do it anyway.
Well, as you say, the locals are allowed to veto wind farms now, which is a big issue in the Tory shires. We don't want a wind farm on our backyard. But if you want to frack in mostly Labour Lancashire, well, what the locals want doesn't make any difference. So I remember some Tory MP some while ago saying, well, surely we should do the fracking up in the north where there aren't any people, not in my constituency. I think that the fracking industry is on the ropes in the United States of America because of the low oil price forced by the Saudis and others to try and bankrupt.
So is this a reason why maybe they're trying to make sure it goes ahead here in Britain? Is because it's having difficulty in the US, and it looks like confidence is going out from those that are invested in fracking?
Indeed, and I think it's very revealing that this government in particular is so beholden to corporate lobbyists that it's prepared to push this, even though there's virtually no popular support for it whatsoever. But they've been receiving, no doubt, funding and kickbacks and all the rest of it, which makes them very, very pro fracking.
Are you alleging the government getting kickbacks? How dare you say that?
No, I'm not saying individual kickbacks, but the Tory party itself will be raising funds, and those funds will be coming from people with interest in the fracking.
Ron, I don't get this. I don't get this, Ron. I mean, one law for those that are polluting the water supply, causing earthquakes and all sorts of dreadful things that are associated now with fracking, as the Americans have taught us. You know, even be able to set fire to your water as it comes out of the tap. Amazing stuff if you go online and see the effects of fracking. And yet, if you want to stop a wind farm, it's fine. It's easy. You can do it.
Well, I think our shadow energy secretary has said it all, because she said it's hypocritical for ministers to support devolution and local democracy for decision-making over wind farms, only to trample all over the views on local communities on fracking. And she's totally right, isn't she?
Another story, even more retailers are refusing to sell genetically modified salmon. Well, you may have heard last week about genetically modified salmon being approved for sale by the Food and Drug Administration in the United States. It's the first animal product to be actually genetically modified, yet you can buy this GM salmon. But what you may have not have heard, and this I found in a magazine in the States I'd never seen before, it's for the food industry called Grub Street. Clint Rainey Follow was the Follow is his Twitter thing. But Clint Rainey has written this article saying Frankenfish's marketability continues to look complicated at best. Costco, America's largest seller of salmon, is the latest company to express alarm at biotech America's Aqua Bounty's new creation, Aqua Bounty they're called, a salmon that's the first genetically modified animal approved by the Food and Drug Administration for human consumption. Maybe Martin, you can give us a little hand. I mean, I know this is in the States, but you know, these things tend to sort of find their way across the Atlantic eventually. We hear that this has been approved for sale, but actually one of the biggest retailers in the States that says we're not selling any of this stuff.
Well, in actual fact, around the world, this is turning into a bit of an issue. Because the thing about having any kind of GMO-produced crops, salmon or anything else, is that it actually leaks into the environment. So GMO-modified salmon, their DNA is potentially going to leak into the wild salmon population, etc., etc. So you can't separate it from what may happen to non-GMO crops. And incidentally, the Russians have just said that they are going to commit to completely non-GMO food production, and they see it as a possibility for them as a big export market. If the Americans want to go down the road of contaminating their food supply with GMO, we are not going to do that. So buy our stuff, because it's going to be produced with organic methods. And I think the policy of the European Union has always been, they have essentially a preventive policy. So unless you can show that it's not dangerous, we presume that it might be. Whereas the policy in the US generally is to presume things aren't dangerous until they prove that they are. And this is now being forced through the two free trade agreements, the one with the European Union, the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
But you see, we've got a problem here, is that a salmon could actually be a Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership salmon. It could swim, couldn't it, over to Russia? And it could mate with the Russian perfect non-GMO things.
That's the problem with all GMO stuff, is that it can contaminate the whole... I mean, what they're pushing for in the US under the Transatlantic Pacific Partnership is that you won't be able to label things as GMO or not GMO, so that consumers will not know whether they are consuming GMO salmon or anything else, because the label won't tell them.
Ron, what do you make about this? Because there is this thing called Terminator technology, isn't there, both in the plants and in animals, where if a genetically modified plant or animal mates with a non-GM, it can produce infertile progeny. Now, that's quite a problem, isn't it? Because it means that you're starting to completely pollute the food. I seem to remember a James Bond film, actually, about this. Was it on Her Majesty's Secret Service with Telly Savalas threatening the world that he was going to do this? Well, it now looks like some of this Terminator technology is really being rolled out.
Yeah, well...
but anyway, at least one of the biggest American retailers is saying we're not selling any of this stuff.
Well, if you remember... Bristol had an agricultural research station attached to the university at Ashton in the village there. And that was basically trying to look at making crops more resistant to disease in the first instance. But with this salmon... where you've got the fish farms and where they're feeding fish food to or trying to change the genetic makeup, it's all about trying to make them bigger and fatter and more per fish, etc., etc. It's all chasing profit. And as you say, the dangers of such thing, salmon are quite agile, as you know. They can escape quite easily. And again, cross-mating, you don't know what you're going to get or how it can affect it. And certainly sterility is one thing that can arise from it. So I think it's a very difficult subject. It started with good intentions, but it's got the ability to be able to radically change our local wildlife over a period of, say, 50 years.
Martin, would you eat this stuff?
No. Not really. I mean, one of the problems is, because of these trade agreements, is that people won't know what they're being sold. Because the deals in it is that they won't be able to label things as GMO or not GMO. And, of course, what's happened in the States is that GMO grain has been mixed into the general grain production quota, and nobody knows what is GMO and what's not GMO. And once you've done that... Then Monsanto and the companies that behind all of this can waltz home, because no matter what people think, it's impossible to turn the clock back and say we'll go back to a pre-GMO era, and that's the real danger with it. And of course, it's all done, as Ron was pointing out, for private profit. If carrying out research into how to improve crops in a general sort of a way is one thing, but when companies are doing it in order to improve their own profit margins, then that's a different thing altogether.
Now, just to mention briefly, I mean, it's very difficult to know what to make of it, but we've got a siege going on up in Stapleton, up near Frenchay, and apparently it's been going on for a day now. It continues, say ITV, nearly 24 hours after it started, and Park Road in Stapleton has been evacuated and cordoned off since yesterday evening. Police say they do not believe there's any risk to the wider public. They suspect that the chap that's hauled up in this place, inside in the middle of the siege, may be armed, but they're just basically advising people to avoid the area. Certainly if you're driving up that way, you'll have to go some other way, won't you? But Probably a final, I think, story tonight. Pay inequality. The salary gap between average wages and those of top executives is widening every year. It's reaching stratospheric levels, apparently. This is in The Independent, Andy McSmith on Monday. With $43 million annual pay packet, Sir Malcolm Sorrell is Britain's top paid boss. The gap between average wages and the pay Britain's top company executives receive is still widening year by year, despite David Cameron's mantra that we're all in this together. New research shows that the remuneration at the very top rose by 8.1%, with at least 535 company executives now receiving over £1 million a year. The highest paid was Sir Martin Sorrell, chief executive and advertising and PR group WPP, whose latest £43 million remuneration package included £274,000 worth of flights paid for so his wife could accompany him on business trips, plus $50,000 he's reckoned to have saved the company on hotel bills by staying in his New York flat and other homes during business trips. Pay inequality, and also this week we hear, Ron, that the British pensions that Britain get are the worst. Only workers in Mexico and Chile get worse from their state pensions. It's not good, is it?
No, it's not good, and quite honestly, it's hardly surprising with the current Prime Minister and his cabinet. I think the last election there was 50 millionaires in it, at least, if not more. And you only got to look at the five-year austerity plan that they've got for local authorities to see the haves and have-nots, and the people that are at the bottom on benefits being blamed for everything and being screwed into the dust and ground to pieces, while people are with these type of quite obscene salary levels are investing it offshore and not paying their tax.
Martin, it sounds like government by the rich for the rich.
Well, that's pretty much what it is, isn't it? Let's not beat about the bush. And I think the other thing that people need to realise is that forcing down the wages of the ordinary workers, which is effectively what's been going on, ultimately doesn't work, because you then get a situation where they can't buy the production that they've created, and that the days of prosperity for ordinary people in Britain were when wages were rising year on year, when the trade unions had some clout and all the rest of it. And incidentally, I noticed that Sir Martin Sorrell is head of a PR company. And what PR and advertising does, from an economical point of view, is it creates barriers to entry for new entrants into an industry. So the main function of advertising is to make it difficult for new people to set up in that industry. So in actual fact, you could argue that that is actually waste from an economic point of view, and that advertising, it's not really as surprising as that advertising executives are the most overpaid of all of them. And it says a lot, doesn't it?
Well, maybe they have quite a bit of influence on the London media. I mean, we were talking about earlier on just how much spin there is, and in fact, journalists not checking their facts.
Well, whenever we come to general elections, you get the scenario where the mainstream media are suggesting that nobody wants to increase taxes. And what they mean by that is journalists like us, who are paid, you know, 50 to 70 grand, do not want to increase in taxes. Well, we know that. You were part of the lucky slice of people in Britain who earn that kind of money. The average wage in Britain is still something around 20 grand, which means half people are earning less than that.
Ron, what about the pension side of things? Because I think for many of us this is pretty disappointing, isn't it? Mexico, you know, that's where we are.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that says it all. And like I said, I don't think pension levels, if you look at it across Europe, for example, we're the worst that you can find in that level. I've been to Sweden and I've seen what Sweden do with their pension levels, for example. But coming back again, linking that and the pay levels, there's people in my ward that like a job.
Yeah, OK, Ron, we have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, that was Labour Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Syria and the Bristol Group after the news.
Is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.